Joelle, the floor is yours.
Okay.
You can share.
Thank you, Louisa. I appreciate it. Thanks for holding space for us today, Louisa. Rose, thanks for asking me to speak today. I appreciate it. And thank you all for being here. This is so encouraging being around other people that are sober, especially living in a country that is ninth in the world for beer consumption per capita. It's really refreshing to be around people that aren't insisting that I have a drink. I'm Joe, I'm an alcoholic. 16 years ago today, I had my last drink. However, it's not my anniversary. I didn't know I was going to go to AA. I didn't know I was going to get sober. I just woke up at 1:23 in the afternoon. I still remember that digital clock back when I had digital clocks, and it said 1:23, and I thought it was morning, but I couldn't understand where the bright light was coming from, and I was all confused. I couldn't believe that the guests were gone. The day before, I cooked a dinner party for eight people. I'm a chef, so it's unusual for chefs to be off on weekends, but it was a Friday night, and I cooked for eight of my friends. And at 3:30, I remember this as clear as day. I started cooking at 3:30 for the dinner party, and I was having a Guinness. It was my first drink of the day. And I even said out loud, I said, "Tonight you will not get wasted. Just you can have a buzz tonight. That's it." I don't remember the end of the evening, to be honest with you. I don't remember a lot of things about that night. The things I do remember were very atypical of me and things that I strongly didn't went against my principles, I'll put it that way. I was flirting with my buddy's girlfriend, which I didn't even find her attractive. I don't mean to be mean about that, but she's not here. And I mean, she kind of was, but she was very kind and very sweet. And but anyways, that was bizarre to me. I did it in front of my buddy. I did it in front of my then wife, which, there were some things. When you tell people that you're a recovering alcoholic that aren't, they just automatically assume certain things about you. And that's all I'll really share about my drinking today, because I drank for 30 years. The last 15, I was drunk almost every night. Not every night, but almost every night. I didn't drink and go to work and stuff like that. But the things that didn't happen, I don't know if this is familiar to any of you, but back where I got sober, which is Asheville, North Carolina, in 2008, we called it these things yets. I never had a DUI. I never been arrested. I never got into a fight. I never cheated on a partner. I never was homeless. I never got fired. And towards the end of my drinking, I'd even been pulled over by police once while I had nine shots of liquor in me, and he gave me a speeding ticket. That's how lucky I was. And then one day something happened. I was driving drunk, and it really made me think that I'm going to skip all that stuff. And one day, what's going to happen? I was totally convinced that this was going to happen in my life. I was going to hit another car and kill somebody else. I was absolutely 100% convinced that was how my life was going to play out. And that was on my mind a lot. But because I drove thousands and thousands of times drunk, like very drunk, like, I mean, wasted, sometimes even blackout. Even as a teenager, I would run downstairs to see if my car was in the driveway. Where the hell, how did I park? Where is it? It was always there, no problem. I lost my car in Santa Fe, New Mexico once, got drunk and forgot where I parked it. But so anyways, that was, we all know what drinking is. As far as drugs, I did get into I never started smoking pot on a regular basis till I was 30. I went through a divorce. I always say that's the year I became a real alcoholic on November 26th of 92, because that was the date of my first divorce. And I went out and got wasted that night. Actually, I went home and got wasted. And that started it. It became almost a nightly thing for the next 15 years. I guess that I dabbled in drugs a little bit, weed, mushrooms, and then eventually one day I was in the kitchen. I was a chef, as I said, and we had an accident between me and another cook. I didn't see him, and I got a third degree burn on my arm. So this gave me 750 milligrams of hydrocodone, an endless supply. They said, just let us know when you're out, we'll give you all you want. What the hell is that about? And then I had a medical procedure, and doctor says, I'll prescribe you hydrocodone. I said, right on. So I was playing these two doctors, getting all this hydrocodone, and I was started doing that and mixing it with alcohol, and then I would go out, which was crazy. But that was I didn't do acid, coke, speed, crack, meth, anything like that. I only did the pills for about 2 months. And one day driving home, I was all excited to go home and get my hydrocodone. By the time I got home, I decided, hey, you know what? You're going to fuck up your life really bad with these. You're going to kill yourself. I went home and threw them out. I'm sorry about my language. I just realized what I said there. I still talk like a chef, so I apologize for that. On the day of February 16th of 08, when I woke up and I said, I'm not gonna drink ever again. I haven't had a drink since then. And I hated AA for the first 3 years, or so, maybe longer. I don't remember. I did have an amazing sponsor. After I fired my first sponsor, who was one of my best friends, that was stupid. Why did I think I could do that? And why did he think he could do that? That should have never happened. I don't think you should have one of your best friends be your sponsor. That's for me personally. I'm not giving advice. For me, it did not work. I fired him after 5 months. I was getting ready to start drinking again, and I didn't. But, I hated AA and I hated going. I would go to one meeting a week. I would go maybe 5 minutes late, and I would leave as soon as we got done with the serenity prayer, so nobody could talk to me. And that was my dedicated that as much dedication as I was to AA then. And I had all sorts of people give me advice, telling me I was never going to make it. I mean, who the hell would ever tell a newcomer that? You're never going to stay sober. Someone said something this morning about, there's some really shitty advice going around out there in the rooms, between AA and non and secular meetings. And I still go to some regular traditional AA meetings, but I had people tell me, that you're never going to make it. You're the angriest person I ever met. Things like that, which probably helped me, because I had someone tell me too that I'd never be a cook, and it's been 45 years. I've spent my whole day today in the kitchen cooking for a dinner for guests at our little Airbnb here in Croatia. So sometimes, it's like Michael Jordan said that, when he got cut from basketball and what the freshman year in high school, whatever it was, it made him more determined to play basketball and be good at it. And so I remember telling my ex-wife, this one guy told me, I'm never going to make it. And I said, if you ever come home and find me with a bullet in my head, it's because I didn't want Harry to be right. Like, if I felt like myself, I was going to go drink. I didn't want this guy to be right about me going back out so much that I said I would shoot myself in the head. I don't know what I'd shoot myself with because I didn't own a gun. But so there was a lot of. I would go and tell my sponsor these things, or I'd call him and say, these people are just giving me shit about everything. It's like he said, there's another saying. It's not really a AA slogan, but some of these people are here because they're not all there. And I like that. And I find that there's are a lot of people in here for all sorts of reasons, really. Some of them are to become like a control freaks or whatever the case is. I seem to be running into that a lot, but I didn't want to give up drinking either. So we'll skip ahead to a couple. Well, then I got remarried, and I'll just put this out there right now that my most, I know this isn't the fourth or fifth step, but my most embarrassing and shameful thing to say about my life is that I've had three failed marriages. I moved here with my wife. She was from Croatia. We came here on vacation. I really wanted to move here. Eventually, some things, weird things were going on in North Carolina. The hate crimes on immigrants were skyrocketing. This was in 2016, and she was a teacher, and she had kids bringing knives and bullets to class. And she said, "It's just a matter of time." I said, "Well, it's you're probably right, you know." And they would tell her to go fuck herself, that she's an immigrant, and she shouldn't be living in their country, and things like that. So I remember asking her on August, "Hey, can we just sell everything, just go? Like, I don't want to do this anymore, just way of life." And no, I needed 10 more years. 2 months later, she said, "You know what?" She was in tears one day coming home from work. She said, "I'm ready to move too." I said, "All right, let's make it work." So the following June, we moved here, which was 2017. Excuse me. We moved here, and we lived somewhere temporarily for 2 months so I could go to AA meetings live in English on Monday nights. I had to drive an hour to get there, which was amazing. It was wonderful. Then we bought this house that, well, she lives in the main house now, as I'm divorced from her as well. She lives in the main house, which is where the Airbnb is, and I live in what the Croatian word is, kućica, a cottage. I live in a cottage behind, so we share our dogs, and which is nice, and we get along okay. I mean, it's, everything's cool there, but so we're now living in Croatia. Once we moved here, it's a village. It's like an old fishing village of 1,200 people. I mean, there's guys that drink beer for breakfast. You can go downtown in the coffee bars. A coffee bar is a bar. They serve coffee. They serve alcohol. When I go for coffee, I have to go to a bar. For me, it's not. It doesn't matter. But so now all of a sudden, I have no meetings to go to, and this was before Zoom meetings. 2017. So I would drive sometimes an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes to go to a meeting that wasn't even in English. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm using up a lot of gas, I'm making no money, I'm not doing this anymore. I tried an online meeting back then. You had to type everything you said. I said, "Oh, the hell with that." And so I didn't go to a meeting for like almost, I think, like a year, year and a half. And then Zoom and COVID came along, and that was a amazing thing for me. But I wasn't going even. And one day, out of the blue, somebody from back home wrote an email, one sentence, one question: "Are you going to meetings now that they're on Zoom?" I said, "I'm not. Why the hell am I not?" And I'll tell you what, this has been for me the greatest thing that's ever happened for me to get to meetings. I don't have to drive anywhere, I don't have to park. All the meetings here are everybody. Like when I went to Split, which is an hour and a 45 minutes from here, 10 of us were in the room, 9 of us were smoking, and I thought I was going to vomit. I just can't handle that. So life here was very stressful. My first 2 years, I had no support. I had no AA support. Then I started on the meetings, the COVID meetings, like I said, and that was absolutely beautiful. Our relationship was like really bottoming out hard from all the stress that we opened a business together. Everything I had to go and do, my wife had to go be my interpreter. So I was like a little baby being, I hated that. I'm an independent person normally, and I despise that. So our relationship was bottoming out. And then 2.5 years ago, I started having a sharp pain in my stomach. And I went, and after 2 months of researching, like with doctors, a lot of doctors, like, "What the hell's going on?" I was diagnosed with stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So more tests. I finally was put in the hospital, blah, blah, blah. Got started on chemo. I never, when I got that news that, "Hey, you've got stage 4 cancer," I didn't have a desire to run out and grab a drink or smoke a joint or something, you know. That's a relief, man. That's so different for me. I imagine probably be different for a lot of us. You know, I used to drink a lot when I had problems, or when I didn't have problems, or when I was celebrating, whatever. But problems or anger, for sure, I would drink a lot, an extra amount, you know. But I didn't have that desire. That was a true miracle for me, you know. And then I was in my first round of chemo, steroidal therapy, immunotherapy, all that. I would drive myself there, go through all that stuff on my own. And then one day, and I was just about halfway through it, I guess about 4 months after my diagnosis, my wife said she wanted to split up. So I didn't beggar to stay. I never wanted to be somewhere where I'm not wanted, which reminded me kind of like my early sobriety. I really didn't feel wanted or appreciated or anything in AA. But so not much was said about that. The strange thing for me was I can become a very emotional person. My therapist, when I got sober, told me, she says, "You're a good crier for a man." And I'll tell you what, I didn't cry when I was told that I had cancer, and I didn't cry when my wife said she wanted to leave. And then four, 5 months after she split up, she told me she wanted out. This is just 2.5 years ago now. My dad died. And the day after my dad died, I had to go and hear the results of my PET scan after which was, you know, after my first round, I guess. It was six sessions of chemo, and I was declared my cancer was declared in remission, which was I can't describe the emotions, but I can certainly feel them right now. Dad died one day, I'm in remission the next. The very next day, I was on a plane back to the United States. And my dad always told me he wanted me to do the eulogy at his funeral. Not My dad had a very strained relationship with all of his kids, five of us. And he used to hit me when I was a kid, you know. And I mean, to where I'd have bloody noses and so forth, things like that. Which I always resented him for. We had huge arguments over it as adults. We eventually talked about it. I forgave him for what I thought I had to forgive him for, and I hope he forgave me for all the things that I needed forgiving, you know, forgiveness for. But I did give it a eulogy, stayed sober. What I mean, I look at my dad's funeral and all that whole time, which is really precious time with your family. I also looked at it as the biggest, most important event of my life was my dad's funeral. And I got to be there for my mom. And my brothers and sisters. And I was sober through the whole thing. I don't know how that happens. I don't know how this works. I'm just so grateful that it does. Last summer, I was feeling horrible again. I went back and they decided that my cancer had returned. A couple weeks ago, we were told by the doctors overseeing my mom, she's 91, that she has probably between a week and several months to live. They said, "We can't pinpoint it, but she won't be getting any better than she is right now." So, you know, I'm kind of waiting on that. The toughest part, my mom has made, she asked me to promise her I would not drink when I died, and I told her I wouldn't do that. Because not that I plan on drinking, not that I think I will, I really think I won't. That's such a, I hate to use the word blessing. I feel it's such a miracle to go through the death of a parent. To go through these big things in life, divorce, cancer, everything, which are all normal parts of life, you know? It's not like I had a child die, which is a really, I don't have children, but so when my mom asked me, "Would you promise me you won't drink when I die?" Because her and I are very close. She's been my rock since I was born. And I'm just an alcoholic. So like that was obvious when I was probably 3 years old. I was breaking shit. I was in trouble all the time. Grades all through school were horrible until I got to college. Then I realized this is a lot of fun learning. So my mom was always there. I also had a severe stutter when I was a child. I had it from the time I started school to the time I graduated culinary school. And I really think it was just nerves from hating school so much. I'm dyslexic and have learning disabilities, so it was very stressful for me. But my mom was there through all that, and she's probably the only reason I finished school. Not that my dad wasn't supportive; he was very supportive as well, especially with my career. He really helped me get that going and off the ground. But I told her I wouldn't promise her that I'd stay sober for her when she passed away, because really, I believe, anyways, just my belief that you can't get sober to save a relationship. You can't get sober for your wife, for your kids. It'll certainly help all that, I believe, but I can't stay sober because I told my mom I would. I have to stay sober because for me and because I want this, and I want this so bad. Like I really, truly want to die sober. And I don't mean coming back. I'm really focused on trying to do what I can. I come to these to SNUA meetings. I go to some traditional ones back in the States. I constantly work on my spirituality. I meditate every morning, which I really, really enjoy. So I'm trying to do the next right thing, I was always told. And I haven't drank through or used through anything, any of these big hurdles that life throws at us so far, and I know my mom will be the biggest challenge when she passes. Sitting on that damn plane, I always have to have an aisle seat, and it's always the bottle of scotch on that cart right next to my head, So I just look out the window, I just look the other way. I was like, just, I can smell alcohol in the air on the plane. Who hadn't love to get drunk in airports. I mean, anyone that flew a lot. I used to fly to Italy to go to cooking school from the States, and I would get hammered on the plane, get hammered in the airport, take a day or so to recover and start getting hammered in Italy. So that is tough. It's a tough enough flight, it's anywhere from 14 to, I don't know, I've had some problems with flights before, and it's taken me over 2 days to get there. So that's a difficult challenge, which I am concerned with. I'll stay in touch with my sponsor about it. I will do meetings, the best I can. But back where I came from in the States, when you celebrated and you went up to get a chip, people would say, "How did you do it?" And my honest, I don't know. I don't know how I did it. Somebody recently asked me, "If you we're going to write an autobiography, what would you call it?" I'd say the luckiest man alive, because that's how I feel. They said, "But you have stage four cancer." I said, "I'm still lucky. I got the United States decided to give me disability to live on. I'd be totally screwed over here if I didn't have it, I mean, I did pay into the system for 50, was it 45 years? I think she said. But I never expected I'd really get it, So I'm lucky. There's things that happen to you when you have cancer in your head, that all of a sudden they're not important anymore. Those little things that really piss you off. Okay, I still get pissed off in traffic. Sorry. But I'll try and let go of that one day too. But that some of the small things anymore, I can see a little more clearly. Knowing that I have cancer, I probably have less time to live than I thought I would. That stuff doesn't mean shit anymore. It just is not important. So, there's some gifts coming even from the darkest corners of my life. But being sober and having connections with all of you and the other groups that I go to is the greatest gift. And, a big thing here, a couple posted one day on Facebook at this group. It's not a sober group, but it's for expats from that live in this area that we get together once in a while to chat and have a coffee and stuff. And this couple said, "Hey, does anyone want to have coffee?" I said, "I'll meet you tomorrow. I'll be there." And we got talking an hour into our conversation. They told me that they each had 8 years of sobriety. In 3 months, 4 months, we've become incredible friends, and they thank me every time for just being a sober friend here in this country, So, yeah, it's a true miracle sobriety. It's the biggest gift I've ever been given. I hope, of course, I hope that I don't ever go back out, but I will have to say that the connection with those of you that people I've never met, and the connection I have with my other AA people is the most important thing. And when you come to these meetings and you share your experiences, that to me gets in my head, gets in my heart. And, especially when people say, "I've got a week sober," that just blows my mind. And it hits me so deep that I don't ever want to go out again. So when I listen to you guys share your experience, strength, and hope, that really confirms my belief in recovery, whether it be secular or traditional meeting or anything like that. So this is the greatest gift I've ever received, and I'm happy we have these Zoom meetings that allows people to come here and support my sobriety, and I can come here for you guys and help you support yours. That's all I have. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your support and your love here today. I appreciate it.